I was a dog off the leash, Paul. It was like, he goes, I want you running around. I want you jumping up on the risers. I want you right up front in the guitar solos. Get out there in the spotlight. He only had to tell me once, brother.
There were times when the Beatles came in the office, you know, and I was like, couldn't open my mouth, you know. John and Paul, saw them write a song or two, but I'm not going to mention that.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Vintage Rock Pod, the podcast series that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now, I've got a bumper show lined up for you today with not one, but two fantastic interviews. Now, we love classic rock stories, and these two guys have got some fantastic connections. You're going to hear stories about rubbing shoulders with the Beatles, winning an award for working with Elvis in his music catalogue before he died, and about the late Ken Hensley. All from a man with more than 50 years in the music business, David Bowie's former manager, no less, Steve Weltzman. But before we get him, though, we're going to hear from a brilliant guitar player as well, singer-songwriter who had number ones on the rock charts in America in the 90s. He's a member of Thin Lizzy and played with Alice Cooper on multiple tours and albums, as well as many, many more. He's got a new album and a new band. I'll be speaking to Damon Johnson. But before we hear from Damon, a quick thank you to the raft of people who signed up to become a VRP VIP last week. I really do appreciate you all joining in. It's really simple. Just go to vintagerockpod.com and fill in the form on that page, and you'll get the chance to ask a question to future guests. You'll find out first who's on upcoming episodes, and you'll be in with a chance of winning goodies too. So just sign up now, vintagerockpod.com. Don't be missing out. We've also got a load of reaction last week to the Jeff Downes interview that I did, in particular his revelation that he had unfinished material with John Wetton that he still had to work on. I shared this on social and it got spread across the old Facebook and Twitter like crazy, and also got picked up by a few music news outlets too, which is always nice, you know. I want to say hello to Pat McGeoch from Ireland, Charlotte Lewison in Tennessee, and Corey Beaumont in Georgia for reaching out on email this week. A whole host of folks on YouTube, Martin Osborne, Martin Kelcher, Dave J, Christopher Yem, Janine Humberto, and Jack Elquist, and everyone else who's messaged me and left comments and things like that on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter too. It really is much appreciated. I love conversing with you all. Please feel free to reach out on all the socials. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod. And lastly, a quick shout out to former guest on the show, Dire Straits original drummer Pick Withers. Now, his online gig with his new band Slim Pickens happened on Saturday night. It was fantastic. It was a great selection of songs, a nice chilled Saturday night vibe, and I hope you enjoyed it too if you purchased a ticket. Right, now on with the show, and it was a great pleasure chatting with my first guest, no stranger to playing here in the UK as part of Thin Lizzy and one of his recent bands as well, Black Star Riders. It's another great engaging conversation, and we talk about his new band and his new album, and I've got permission to play some of the tracks, so enjoy this interview with Damon Johnson, and we'll lead in with the first track on this new album. It's the title track of the album. It's called Battle Lessons. Now, I'm delighted to say my next guest on Vintage Rock Pod is a man who's been in some incredible bands. We're talking Black Star Riders, we're talking Brothers Kane, we're talking working with Alice Cooper, Thin Lizzy, and now with his own band, Damon Johnson and the Get Ready. He's got a brand new album out, and we're delighted to speak to him now. We're going to speak to the main man himself. Damon, welcome to Vintage Rock Pod.
My pleasure, Paul. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm good, man. I'm good. It's great to speak to you. As I said, you've been in some incredible bands and still with some incredible bands as well. You've got one heck of a story to tell, which I'm looking forward to hearing about. But let's get on with your album. It's fantastic. I've had a good few listens to it. Battle Lessons. It's really hard. It's a good rocking album. Is that what you wanted to do when you set out, when you started to record and write for this one?
I think so, yes. The first two songs that we wrote for this record were track number two, Can't Clap Any Louder, and a song toward the end of the record called Lightning Bolt. Mm-hmm. And both of those songs they were so much fun for me to I remember sitting in, this is my little office here, this is where I make my demos and stuff like that, and I just remember working on it. And I wrote most of these songs with my old friend Jim Troglin, just one of my best mates, and I remember sending him the demos, and his reaction, he was like, what? Like, this is amazing. So I think especially after those two songs were written, I just made a conscious decision like, hey, let's make a focused, riff heavy, badass rock and roll record.
Rock out.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. And how long has it taken to get to where we are now? Because it's just come out, hasn't it? It's just been released, but it's been in the works for a while.
It has, mate. We started writing those songs back in October of 2019.
Crikey.
And we went into the studio with my great friend, producer legend, Nick Raskulinix. And we started really the end of February, early March, almost a year ago right now is when we were working. And because of his busy schedule, we had already decided to record the songs in groups of three. So like we would do three songs, he would go back to some mega band that he was producing, and then we would come back later. But I'll never forget it being out in the vocal booth. We had recorded the title track, Battle Lessons, Can't Clap Any Louder, and Let the Healing Begin. I was singing, and Nick came over the talk back, and he said, hey, brother, the NBA just canceled their entire season, you know, because of COVID.
Yeah.
And right at that moment, you know, we knew, okay, we're going to have to close the studio. It's just, yeah. So I felt like that was an interesting point to bring up because, you know, again, that was a year ago, brother.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't until I think June or July that we got in to do three more. And then the final three, we finally got in October, okay. Maybe the 1st of November, actually, is when we did the final three. So yeah, not ideal. Not ideal to make a record that way, but I could not be more pleased with the results. And, you know, I guess we'll always look at it like, hey, you just do what you have to do. And I'm just grateful, man, that it's out and that the reaction has been so positive as it has been.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said before, it is a really rocking album. It's a fast album. It's up there. My favorite track on it, if you don't mind, is track four, Shadow Country. I love how it's really ominous to start with. It's almost kind of brooding, isn't it? And then the bass drum kicks and then the guitar comes in and it's just brilliant. I love it.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's a very, very special song. That is the one track on the album that had not been written when we started the record.
Okay.
It was between those first two groups of songs. You know, we were on the break and I remember Nick calling me. He said, hey man, listen, we're going to have to wait anyway. He goes, if you can write another song or two, it never hurts. Let's see if we could come up with something that, you know, can rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. I felt like that's what we were able to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great track. And in terms of the release and everything that yourself, it's an independent release, isn't it? It's one that you've put together and kind of done on your own back.
Everything's in-house, brother. This is our little mom and pop operation. Myself and my wife and my kids. This past 3 weeks has been just filled with shoving CDs into envelopes and t-shirts and signing things. And it's been a lot of fun. You know, you never know what the future holds, Paul. I think that it would certainly be fantastic to work with the right label partner.
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't come across that situation yet. There were a couple offers on the table, you know, from some good companies, but I really like the idea of ownership. You know, owning the record myself, kind of being in charge of the decision making about, you know, what publicists to work with, how to treat working in at radio, and even the distribution.
Yeah.
You know, distribution is almost, it's kind of a joke now because there is no distribution. People stream it.
Yeah.
They can certainly order the physical copies off my website, but it's not like it's in the shops at what's the big record store in the UK?
like HMV or something like that. Yeah.
HMV. Thank you. It's not like HMV is going to be carrying the Damon Johnson and the Get Ready records. So, you know, but the fans in the UK have been amazing. You know, I have filled so many orders and
brilliant.
You know, it's interesting because now you guys are dealing with Brexit and that's absolutely affected the cost of shipping. And I remember my wife being like, oh no, what a mess. And I'm like, hey, look, the fans want this record. We're going to do whatever we can to get it to them. So
Good stuff.
Yeah, man. Double Dragon Records. We're proud to be putting out all my solo stuff on that imprint.
Brilliant. And like you said, you can stream it, that sort of stuff. But if people like me want the hard copy, then you can get a CD, you can get 180 gram vinyl as well. And just give us your website again so we can all log in and purchase that.
Yeah, Paul, thank you. Simply DamonJohnson.com. Everything's right there at your fingertips. It's real easy to navigate my website. I'm really proud of how the site is looking right now. Thank you. Yeah, man, we're turning those orders around within 48 hours, you know. As a matter of fact, if you order one today, we'll ship it today.
There you go. That's a promise. Damon, we've got you on. It'd be remiss of us not to talk about some of the other acts that we mentioned at the start there. I mean, some incredible lineup. Let's start with, Alice Cooper. Shall we just throw a big name out there? You worked with Alice.
That's a big name.
Indeed it is. Yeah, you worked with him for a while, didn't you? Played on an albums, toured with him many, many times. And how did all that come about then?
In 2004, my old friend Eric Dover was playing guitar in Alice's band. He had been in the band for at least 3 or 4 years at that time. And Eric was getting ready to move on to do some other things. And he told Alice, he said, I know the guy that would be the right fit to come in and replace me if he's available. So Eric called me one night. He was a bit in the bag. I think he'd had a few drinks. And he just said, hey man, I'm gonna leave this gig. And I'm going to tell them you're the guy. So I think they're going to want you to audition. And I just remember thinking, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to, you know, I just thought Eric was being nice, maybe a little drunk, you know. And sure enough, man, about a week later, I got a call from the tour manager. We arranged the audition. And, you know, it just wouldn't have happened without Eric. And yeah, man, playing with Alice Cooper is just a massive career highlight for me. It did so much for my confidence, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, to have a legend of Alice's caliber to kind of give me the sign of approval. You know, he's had so many great musicians in his band throughout his career. So I learned a lot from Coop, and there's no question, man, performing with him was a thrill. Writing songs with him was just an honor, man. You know, yeah. It's like, God, Alice has written so many timeless classic hits. You know, I'm just grateful for that experience, man. Coop and I are good friends. I just talked to Alice last week, and, you know, our families are connected, and, you know, our kids have grown up together. So it's fantastic.
Oh, amazing. I know he's a big fan of golf. Did he get you into golf?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that I already played golf a bit when I joined the band. And I remember our very first conversation. He was thrilled when I told him, you know, I asked, I said, hey, can I bring my golf clubs? He was like, what? Yes. Paul, the number of rounds of golf we played is gluttonous. It's not to be believed. If the tour for the entire year, if we played 100 tour dates, we easily, not exaggerating, we easily played 75 or 80 rounds of golf in that year. So do the math, mate. I was in the band for 5 years. That's about 400 rounds of golf.
You must have got some nice courses as well if you're touring the world with Alice Cooper.
Brother, just the stuff of dreams. If you love golf... And the Alice Cooper gig is like, you've just won the lottery. You've literally won the lottery. And I have so many great memories of, so many different tracks. And it's just so much fun with Coop. He's a good hang, and he's so much fun. Really, really love my time with Alice.
And stuff. And you mentioned like winning the lottery. It must have felt like that when you got the chance to perform and play, and you still do when things are working right with Thin Lizzy, because you were a big fan of Thin Lizzy, weren't you, as a kid?
Yeah, that story is really incredible. It's I never tire of thinking about it, much less talking about it, you know, because Thin Lizzy was, you know, they were on my Mount Rushmore of most influential bands on my life, on my music, my guitar playing, later on my songwriting, you know, just massive. And it still doesn't feel real, honestly, Paul. And I know for you guys over there in the UK, I mean, Thin Lizzy, they kind of occupy the same space that a band like Aerosmith does here, or a band like Van Halen does here in the US. Just one of the greatest bands of all time. So it's just been a joy, you know, to stand next to Scott Gorham, my hero, and now my great friend. You know, he's carried me to other places that I would have never gotten to go and perform. And, you know, the passion that Thin Lizzy fans have for the music, it rivals no other band. And the way that those fans accepted me and embraced, you know, whatever energy and whatever musicality I brought to it, is just, again, mate, one of the great honors of my career, because I would be the same way. You know, if I went to see Thin Lizzy and they had a new guitar player, I would be standing there thinking, hey, this guy better be good. You know, he better be good or I'm going to get very frustrated. So, yeah, another career highlight for me. And I'm so proud to be a part of that story.
And can you remember when you first saw or heard Thin Lizzy or anything like that? What got you into Thin Lizzy? What was it that drew you in then to start with?
Paul, it's another incredible story. I was 15 years old in 1979, and I went with my mates to the auditorium about 2 hours north of the little town we grew up in. And we went to see Ted Nugent. We had not heard anything about an opening act. We didn't know. We didn't really care. We're like, you know, we love Ted Nugent's guitar playing and his songs. And so I remember my friend's dad, he pulled in the front of the venue to let us out. And they had one of those big signs out front. And it said, tonight, Ted Nugent, special guest, Thin Lizzy. And I remember saying to my friend, like, oh, I've heard their song. They got that song, The Boys Are Back in Town. That's all I knew. Mm-hmm. So we go in right as the house lights go down. You know, we're standing on the floor, the smoke, the sirens are kicking off. And then there's this big power cord and the spotlights come on. And this 6'4" lanky, skinny black guy playing a Fender precision bass that had a mirrored pick guard on it. And he's shining the reflection into the audience onto the girls. Brother, that was like an explosion. Me and my friends, we were all like, what the fuck is happening? What is this? It's crazy. And, you know, over the course of the next 45 minutes, they pummeled my teenage brain with awesome song after awesome song, great riffs, great songs. And that was it. That was it. You know, I went to the record store the next day. I bought 3 albums and I saved my money. And I think the next month I went back and bought 3 more. So that was it. I was on my way. And Thin Lizzy was heavy, heavy, heavy in my listening, essential listening, really for the rest of my life after that night. Yeah.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible stories. And again, I could speak to you all day, talk about all your stories, but we can only touch on some of the bits here in the interview. And just something else I want to talk about when you're in Brother Kane, you had some big hits over in America and things like that. But again, you toured with some incredible bands. And I'm talking about, you've mentioned them yourself just a few moments ago, like Aerosmith and Van Halen. I mean, again, pinch me moments.
Yeah, totally pinch me moments. Yeah, Brother Kane was such a blessing. You know, for 4 guys from Alabama, you know, Alabama is not like the hotbed of rock and roll bands. It never has been. It's still not to this day. Mm-hmm. So I just remember having this feeling of being a bit overwhelmed constantly. Like, I couldn't believe that our song was on the radio. I couldn't believe that, you know, our song went to number 1 the summer of 93, and then we had another number 1 2 years later. But yeah, those were magical phone calls, you know, that we would get. We'd be on the road, and, you know, this is long before cell phones. So, you know, you'd stop at a truck stop to gas up the van, you know, while we're out touring. And I would call the office and they'd say, hey, Damon, we just got the call. We're going to do 8 dates with Aerosmith, and, you know, running back to the van and telling the guys, oh my God, guess what? You know, so I just think, you know, none of those things that happened afterwards, Paul, would have ever happened had it not been for Brother Kane and that experience. That's what led to Alice Cooper, Thin Lizzy, Black Star Riders, all of that, man. It was a proper band. We got a lot of attention. I learned so much about touring. I learned so much about how the whole business works, mm-hmm. you know, radio and promotion and marketing and publicity. And it's a lot to learn and it takes some time. And that's really what the 90s did for me. It was like an incredible education and an amazing experience.
You talk about education and learning from these guys, the promotion, the radio, that sort of stuff. Did you learn about things like stage presence? And because you are literally touring with masters, aren't you? Did you watch them and go, oh, OK, maybe I shouldn't be doing this or maybe I should be doing that? Did you pick up little tips like that as well?
Yeah, for sure, man. You know, the Brother Kane days were interesting because, you know, we were just a straight ahead rock and roll band. You know, we were as influenced by, you know, Bad Company and the Doobie Brothers as we were influenced by Guns N' Roses and Soundgarden. You know, we loved all that classic rock stuff. So it was a moment in time in the 90s, you know, where grunge was the big thing. And, you know, a lot of bands sort of staring at their shoes. And yeah. There wasn't a lot, it wasn't as much about spectacle and performing and, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But imagine the thrill then to join Alice Cooper, a master showman, a legend in the art of rock performance.
Yeah.
It was like I was a dog off the leash, Paul. It was like he goes, I want you running around, I want you jumping up on the risers, I want you right up front in the guitar solos, get out there in the spotlight. He only had to tell me once, brother. And it was on.
Brilliant. And then Just one last band to touch on, that, if you don't mind, Black Star Riders. They were another big band and still touring and things like that today. I mean, did you enjoy your time with Black Star? I spoke to you before we started the interview there. I've seen you live with the band as well. It was great to see the performance. Did you enjoy your time with the group?
It was just brilliant. Everything about it. I've said it before that I joined Thin Lizzy to play those legendary songs with my hero, Scott Gorham. But you know, I agreed to be a part of Black Star Riders because I wanted to perform and write songs with Ricky Warwick. Ricky was someone that really wasn't on my radar. I had heard of his name. I'd heard of the Almighty. And we had a lot of mutual friends. I remember right when I got the Thin Lizzy phone call, you know, I had some friends call me and go, oh, you're going to love Ricky. You know, he's great. And he was, and he is, and we're great friends to this day. And, you know, I wouldn't be making solo records, Paul, had it not been for my time in Black Star Riders. And I mean that in the total positive way.
Yeah.
I learned so many things, you know, and hey, let's be honest, man, we're talking about, you know, I'm way into my career, mate. I'm, you know, I've been doing this a long time. So what an unforeseen privilege to learn so much. You know, over those years between 2013 and 2018, you know, we made three quality records together. The tours were always fantastic. The fans were great. I have a special place in my heart for Black Star Riders. Always will.
Tremendous. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, Damon. And just as a reminder, the album is out now, Battle Lessons. Everybody, I recommend you get there and download it and stream it and purchase the real thing. Get a copy you can hold in your hands. And Damon, he'll even seal the envelope and send it to you himself. What are you, Damon?
That's exactly what will happen. I'm happy to sign it. I'll even personalize it, man. We love being able to do all this stuff on our own right here out of Nashville, Tennessee. Paul, thank you for your time, buddy. And, you know, again, man, continued success and good health to you and your family. And can't wait to get over there and bring this band.
Absolutely.
Cannot wait to bring the Get Ready to the UK.
We look forward to seeing you too, Damon. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, brother. All the best.
Such a nice guy. And do check out that album as well, Damon Johnson and the Get Ready. It's Battle Lessons, a top album. And the classic rock stories do not stop there, people. No, no way. Here comes another interview. It's number two for this episode. And it contains stories of the Beatles and Elvis and David Bowie and many, many more. It was my pleasure to catch up with music industry stalwart, as I said, David Bowie's personal manager, no less, here to talk all about that and the special new Ken Hensley album, My Book of Answers. Here's my chat with Steve Weltman. Joining me next then on Vintage Rock Pod is a man who's been there, seen it and done it with some of the biggest names in classic rock. And he's here to talk about a very special album indeed. I'm delighted to welcome to the show Mr. Steve Weltman.
Hi. Hi, Paul. Good to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. And yeah, I mentioned you've worked with some of the biggest names in rock, and we'll get to that shortly. But first of all, a special album, an album which is now tinged with sadness. Very sadly, because it's the brand new one from Ken Hensley, who sadly passed away, didn't he, in November last year. But you were his manager for a long time. You knew him really well, didn't you?
Yeah, I actually looked after him for the last 11 years, which I think makes me the longest serving manager he ever had.
You must have done something right then.
Yeah. I just, if I may, correct you.
Okay.
The album is not tinged with sadness. The album, you know, we finished last summer when Ken was alive. Nothing's happened to it since he passed, apart from the fact that we mastered it before he passed, probably about 6 weeks before. Mm-hmm. And we always plan to bring it out this year, around now. The sadness, obviously, is absolutely out of nowhere. He decided to go on his next journey. I last spoke to him on November the 3rd, 6:30 in the evening, kind of around 7:30 the following day, he wasn't with us anymore. It was very, very sudden.
Indeed.
So, the album was made in kind of unique circumstances.
Yeah,
which I could briefly explain or leave you to do.
No, go for it, Steve. You're the man best place to do this. The album's called My Book of Answers. Tell us about the uniqueness behind it.
Ken was always great with his audience, whether it was on the street or on a stage. Ken lived in the middle of nowhere in Spain, mm-hmm. and the nearest airport was Alicante. And Ken had gone to check in for a flight via Moscow to St. Petersburg, and I was flying directly from London. And he got a tap on the shoulder. The chap asked for a photograph, but just pointed the camera at him. Ken said, fine. Mm-hmm. So they both actually got on the plane, both in business class. And during the flight, a stewardess was coming over, translating what this chap was saying. He was a Russian gentleman, lifelong fan. Then he approached Ken a while later and asked Ken if he would do a little private show at his house. In Spain. I can agree, went up for a nice dinner, played a few songs. And this chap said, look, he said, you know, my hobby is poetry. If I send you a couple of poems, do you think you could put music to it? So originally, you know, Ken was polite and said, yeah, I can give it a go. You know, I'll have a look. Never done anything like it. He left the following day, called me and told me. And he said, what do you think? And I can't remember what time of year, I think it was September 19, this would be. And we'd already agreed that we weren't going to do anything the first 3 months of 2020 because we had had a very busy year. Mm-hmm. We had recorded another album earlier in 2019, but we never wanted that out until the end of this year. So there's more to come, folks.
That's good to hear.
So I said, look, you know, when you get some poems, have a look, you know, see if you think you can do something, you know, just try something, do a little demo on your phone or something. There's no need to, you know, bring in people or go into a studio. It's just, this is, you know, for you being nice to a fan. So I can't remember, that. Not that long past, and he got quite a few, quite not two poems, he got a load. And Ken, of course, has... People that know Ken, you know, lyrics are vitally important and has always written all his lyrics. So he said he got them, he's pulled out a couple and started working on them. Then he sent me a couple of demos and said, what do you think? And I said, I like this. I think we should take it a bit further. Just see, I mean, you might have a song here. We could put it on an album. Long story short, before you know it, he's done a bit more, sends an MP3 to Vladimir, the demo, who freaks out. Says he wants to do an album. So that's how the album was born. And the, you know, Vladimir to this day still doesn't speak Spanish, which Ken did. Doesn't speak English, which Ken did. And Ken doesn't speak Russian. Although Russia is a huge market for Ken. Probably our biggest live market in the world.
Yeah. So in terms of the album itself then, musically and things like that, we obviously know Ken's back catalogue, mm-hmm. and Heap and everything like that. How would you describe this album?
Different. It's definitely different. I mean, the first song on the album called Lost My Guardian, you know, if you like, is out the Ken Hensley songbook. Mm-hmm. The third track, which we released the video of last Friday, called The Cold Sacrifice, is probably, it's classic vintage, classic rock Hensley. Yeah. On that track, in the video you see there's Hammond, but it's more guitar-led, that song. And it varies. I mean, the song that's called Stan, Chase the Beast Away.
Yeah.
You know, you could say it's about the virus. It's actually more about the media. Ha ha! The media, Paul.
Yeah, sorry.
and Ken's, you know, had very strong views that the media just want to impart fear on the public. And that certainly relates, the mainstream media, to the virus. No question. Globally, not just in England. And that song is a more, not that they'll play it, but more kind of Radio 2. It has a wider appeal. Probably the nearest thing to prog ends the album. That's a track called Suddenly, which I'd heard an early kind of demo-y version of. When they started really recording it, and Ken sent over to me, he said, what do you think of this? I need some tweaks. And so I called him, but I won't tell you what I said to him about a few elements of the mix. But I said, I got a major problem with it. He said, what's that? I said, it's too short. Steve, it's over 5 minutes. I said, it's too short. I didn't want it to end. The introduction is absolutely brilliant and lasts about 2.5 minutes. Then you get the voice and the lyrics. And I'd rather have the intro as the outro as well.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want it to end. But that's a kind of real prog based vibe to it.
Good, good. And you've kind of teased us as well by saying there's another album on the way. Can you give us any information on that?
No, absolutely not. All I can tell you is it's the most different thing he's ever done, and it's very unique.
Wow, fantastic.
And there are very, very few artists that could have pulled it off. Yeah, it's a very special record, and he absolutely loved it.
And you're talking about later in the year, are we talking autumn time, late summer?
I'm hoping November.
November, okay.
And that will be a year since his passing. So it will be a beautiful celebration.
That's a lovely way to put it. Now, Steve, as we've got you on, it'd be a shame not to talk about the rest of your history as well. Now, I just see your face. Your career goes back over 50 years, doesn't it? It's incredible.
Just waiting for the judge to walk in.
Yeah, now, go. No, I'm only kidding. But yeah, your career started many, many moons ago, didn't it? In the early 60s as a T-boy at, was it Brian Epstein's company?
Yes, at NEMS Enterprises. You know, I was a music fan. Both my parents were musicians. I love music. I was given freedom to listen to anything at home. And I knew Brian's company was called NEMS Enterprises. And I saw an ad in one of the music papers. Brian's office was in Argyle Street, about four doors down from the London Palladium. I was 15 years old, by the way. And my parents were loving, but they shouldn't have let me leave school, but they did. And you could legally then leave at that age. So they bought me a suit. I came out of Oxford Circus tube station and the street was full of kids. And I'm thinking they're all waiting to see the Beatles or, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers or Cilla or Billy J. Kramer, all the acts, because Brian managed all those acts. And so I walked past all these kids, went into Argyle House, and this 6'5" Scouser called Fred, Fred Sefton, said, "Where do you think you're going, la?" And I said, and I pulled out my letter. I went, "I've got an interview with Mr. Peter Brown." And he said, "And so have all those kids outside." So I went, you know, outside. About 10 minutes later, he came out with a megaphone. And he said, "We're going to start the interviews in alphabetical order." This was 2 o'clock.
Oh, no.
You're right. So at 5 o'clock, you know, 3 hours at 15 years old, might as well have been 3 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't even believe I was still there. I walked into Peter Brown's office, and who must have been as bored as me, because he was basically saying the same thing. So I sat down and he said, and he started saying about, right, these are the hours. And I said, "Hang on a minute. Excuse me, Mr. Brown." I said, "How much is job pay? You've kept me waiting out there 3 hours." And he said, I can't remember what he said. He, you know, pays this. And I said, "Well, that's no good. I'm worth 3 times that amount." And he hit his intercom, and I think it was Maureen. And he said, "Maureen," he said, "there's anybody less, tell them to go home. I finally found the cheeky sod we want." So that was the beginning. I worked, well, obviously I did the post, did the mail, ran errands. Used to go a lot over to Brian's London house. Beautiful home in Belgravia, where I often saw John and Paul, who were always in Joanne, his private secretary's office at the top of the house. I saw them write a song or two, but I'm not going to mention that. or the songs, anyway, literally. Predominantly the guy, like, he wasn't my boss, but he helped me an awful lot. The guy is still around and is the leading Beatle expert in the world. His name's Tony Bramwell. And he'd come down from Liverpool with Brian, and he also went on to Apple. So any of your listeners want to know about the Beatles, Tony Bramwell's the guy to check out.
We'll get in touch with him.
So I had a baptism early, the first kind of 2 or 3 weeks. There were times when the Beatles came in the office, you know, and I was like, just, you know, couldn't open my mouth, you know. And then after kind of 2.5-3 weeks, they were just, I realized they only had 2 legs and 2 arms and 1 head. And so that was it. And really, that was, I was very lucky in that sense, because I've never been in awe of any artist I've ever met in the business. Now, if you bought Roger Federer or Tiger Woods or Jack Nicklaus, or Pele, maybe, to me, I'd be a little bit. But otherwise, music people, just they're just great people. Most of them are, anyway. So it was kind of, that was a great learning. And it was a wonderful time. I mean, you know, and nobody knew what they were doing. No, you know. I mean, Brian, obviously, you know, got them suits, had their haircuts, you know, outside of turning them from the, like, the Hamburg Beatles, which I'm sure everybody knows. Yeah. The jeans and the leather jackets into the little boys in the suits. And, you know, but loads of the things that happened. I mean, probably right through that period into the 70s, even in the record business where I ended up for 25 years. I mean, a lot of them in the early days were accidents, because there was nothing to go on. So there was no model that you could look at and think, how did they go about it?
You know. Did you talk about the end of the 70s there and going to work for an idol, an absolute legend, a man that I'm sure you were delighted to go and work for, David Bowie? I mean, how did that come about to start with? How were you asked to join that party?
Yeah, well, When Bill died, who owned Mountain, Nazareth manager, you know, I left and I knew a man in New York called Ken Glancy, who was the worldwide president of RCA Records. He wanted the last X years of his life before he retired to the south of France to be in Europe. So he chose to come to Britain. And he'd known me from my Charisma BNC time and thought I was quite innovative and asked me to go over there. And so I was with David through Low Heroes, Scary Monsters, and the double live album stage. And, you know, I wrote, did all his copy, did all the, created all the marketing, got awards. NME gave me the, I got an award in 78, but in their yearbook, I was given a copy line of the decade.
There you go.
Because when we were coming in the late 70s, you know, we were coming to a kind of hiatus in music, in rock, pop, and as about punk was going to explode, the media decided it was, you were old wave or new wave. We just, David had just finished the Heroes album. So I took double page ads out, and on the left-hand side of the page, as you looked at it, it simply said, there's old wave, there's new wave, and there's David Bowie.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and I still have the award. It's not one I've given away, or very proud of that. And it was, of course, an extraordinary record. You know, David, Bob Fripp, I mean, you know, Tony Visconti, so I mean, great people. You know, Scary Monsters was wonderfully interesting. I have the signed artwork of that album in Fort Knox, by the way, for anybody who's listening. You know, I was at the Rainbow when David did the first live concert of Ziggy with the Lindsay Kemp Dancers. And that was way before, you know, 5 years before I went to RCA. I mean, you know, Guy was...
Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. I could sit and listen to your stories all day, but one more big name that we would like to hear from is, you managed the catalogue of Elvis, or there's some connection with Elvis. What was that?
Oh, well, that's RCA. When I joined, was it beginning of 77? I think I was asked to go into a meeting, and it was about Elvis, not about David. Things were kicked about and people were looking for ideas, and so came up with this idea of going back to the original. Elvis had 16 number one singles in the UK, mm-hmm. and I went to go back to the American picture bags with each single, put them together in a box, started a big campaign called Presley Gold, 16 number ones. I think that was in April 77 it came out. Mm-hmm. And you could only buy the box with six. It was like a just a black cardboard box, but with Elvis, the name in gold on it, and all the picture bags and the singles inside, and it created this huge storm. And then radio starts playing, and then I think 14 of the songs entered the top 30, mm-hmm. and RCA owned its own manufacturing plant and they couldn't keep up with the demand. And then it was going into Europe. And this went right into, was it August? August. And of course he died. And then it was Bedlam. It was Bedlam. RCA, big arguments because I was having David's records manufactured at the RCA plant and they stopped that. And we had to get manufactured by Warner Brothers and EMI because the entire RCA plant was
Elvis.
Manufacturing Elvis. Yes, an extraordinary experience. And I was presented with a wonderfully unique gold disc.
Fantastic.
By the company I could go and read it. It's hanging on the wall at home. Outstanding Management Achievement. That's what it was. But, it's just a shame it was then. Mm-hmm. I wish it had been the 50s. I'd have met him in the 50s because, you know, at the end, he didn't look great, as we all know. And extraordinary. I mean, extraordinary. He changed the world, Elvis.
Certainly did.
He changed the world. It's like a lot of people now, Bono of U2 gets, you know, a lot of stick now, you know, because he's become a very caring person for the last 20 odd years. But if you ask him what inspired him, Elvis. You ask Ken Hensley what inspired him, it was Elvis Presley, you know, and I'm sure there are many, many more.
Absolutely, yeah. There's quite a few that have mentioned him over the weeks that I've been speaking to guests as well. I really do appreciate you taking the time to speak to us today, and I love hearing stories and everything else about some of these incredible artists, and you have had an incredible career. So thank you very much for joining us on Vintage Rock Pod.
So far,
indeed. It goes on. Indeed. For many more years to come, we hope.
Thank you, Paul.
Another fantastic interview there. I love hearing all those stories. It's incredible, isn't it? And now it's time to move on to this week's top five list. But before we get onto the new one, I want to say hello to Joseph K for the chat last week about Asia's top five. My number one choice, Go, he'd never heard of it, but he got in touch to say it was an effing jam. So there you go, he couldn't believe he hadn't heard it. And Robert Hollis as well, who agreed in principle, he says, with the top five, but he'd have found room for Here Comes the Feeling. I always enjoy getting the feedback on these lists. Right, here we go. This week's choice then. It was a difficult one to kind of choose who I was going to pick with all the illustrious names that have been mentioned on the show, but I decided to go with David Bowie, seeing as though we had his manager on the show and all that. Now, when I made this decision, I didn't really think about how difficult it would be just to pick five songs. I sat down and I wrote some songs straight from my mind, and I ended up with about 12 originally. I then went back and listened to the albums again, and that list got to about 23. So I did a bit of whittling down, decided to speak to our good friend Tim Peacock from Record Collector Magazine and YouDiscoverMusic.com. And to be honest, he kind of made things worse by throwing in other songs into the mix. But it's a difficult choice, let's be honest with you, because Bowie had five number one singles in the UK alone, 18 other top 10 hits in an incredible career, which had 9 number one albums. Again, all this just in the UK, and that's not including all the massive hit singles and albums and everything he had everywhere else in the world. So when I give you my top five, remember that on any other given day, it could quite easily be a completely different five songs that I selected. So right here and now, here's my personal top five, which is a thankless task, but anyway, here's the top five David Bowie songs according to Vintage Rock Pod. At five is a track from the 1983 album Let's Dance. It's perhaps poppier than others, but a track I've always loved. It's funky groove, no doubt heavily influenced by Nile Rodgers, who co-produced. At five is Modern Love. Going back to 1974 for our number four, from the album Diamond Dogs, often referred to as his farewell to glam rock. Now, its riff is as recognisable as any from any stadium rock band. It's a song close to me as well, because we used to cover it when I was in a band in college. And number four is Rebel Rebel. At three, we're going to the Hunky Dory album in 1971. It wasn't released as a single until 1973, though. It's a sci-fi masterpiece, one of many anthems, and even as poignant today, given the NASA space mission. At three is Life on Mars. At number two is a song originally written and played by Bowie's short-lived early band Arnold Korns. It found its way onto the legendary The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars album in 1973. Although not a single, it's one of my favourites. It's got a harder edge to this track, and Mick Ronson's soaring guitar work is brilliant. And number two is Moon Age Daydream. And at number one is the anthem to end all anthems, released in 1977 from the album of the same name. It goes down in history for many reasons, legacy reasons. The German government thanked Bowie for helping to bring down the wall with this song. It's a great song. The lyrics are great, the melody drives along, and it's quite rightly regarded on those lists of greatest songs of all time. And number one is the iconic Heroes. As always, let me know your thoughts on that top five list. I do love to hear from you. Check us out on all the social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod. Or drop me an email, vintagerockpod@gmail.com. And that's it for a bumper edition episode 19 then. If it's the first time you've listened, please do go back and check out all the other great interviews in previous weeks. There's some fantastic, incredible big name guests with some great stories to tell. Please subscribe and follow this podcast on whatever platform you listen to your podcasts on. Leave me a nice 5-star rating too, if that's possible. A little review, as it all helps with the ranking and visibility. And to be honest, it's free. And don't forget to sign up to become a VRP VIP at vintagerockpod.com. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your neighbours, tell your colleagues, tell anybody. Get listening to us and join in. Until episode 20 then, remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.